Occupied France, November 23, 1944. 7. Her back hits the rough stone wall. The cell grinds shut, and German soldiers laugh beyond the bars as Addie slumps to the floor, coughing blood. A handful of men huddle in one corner of the cell, slouched and murmuring. At least they don't seem to care that she's a woman. The Germans have noticed, though they caught her dressed in nondescript trousers and coat, though she kept her hair pulled back, she knew by the way they scowled and leered that they could tell her sex. She told them in a dozen different tongues what she would do if they came near, and they laughed and satisfied themselves with beating her senseless. Get up, she wills her weary body. Get up, she wills her tired bones. Addie forces herself to her feet, stumbles to the front of the cell. She wraps her hands around the frozen steel, pulls at it until her muscles scream, until the bars groan, but they do not move. She pries at the bolts until her fingers bleed, and a soldier slams his hand against the bars and threatens to use her body as kindling. She's such a fool. She is a fool for thinking it would work, for thinking that forgettable was the same as invisible, that it would protect her here. She should have stayed in Boston, where the worst she had to worry about was wartime rations and winter cold. She should never have come back. It was foolish honor and stubborn pride. It was the last war and the fact she ran away, fled across the Atlantic instead of facing the danger at home. Because somehow, despite it all, that's what France will always be. Home. And somewhere along the way, she decided she could help. Not in an official sense, of course, but secrets have no owner. They could be touched and traded by anyone, even a ghost. The only thing she had to do was not get caught. 3 years of ferrying secrets through occupied France. 3 years, only to end up here, in a prison outside Orléans. And it doesn't matter that they will forget her face. It does not matter because these soldiers do not care about remembering. Here, all the faces are strange and foreign and nameless, and if she doesn't get out, she is going to disappear. Addie sags back against the icy wall and pulls her ragged jacket close. She closes her eyes. She does not pray, not exactly, but she does think of him. She does, perhaps, even wish that it were summer, a July night when he might find her on his own. The soldiers have searched her, roughly, taken anything she might use to hurt them or escape. They have taken the ring, too, snapped the leather cord it hung on, cast the wooden band away. And yet, when she rifles through her ragged clothing, it is still there, waiting like a coin in the crease of her pocket. She is grateful, then, that she cannot seem to lose it. Grateful as she lifts it to her finger. For a moment, she falters. 29 years she has had the ring with all its strings attached. 29 years, and she hasn't used it. But right now, even Luke's smug satisfaction would be better than the eternity in a prison cell, or worse. If he comes. Those words, a whisper in the back of her mind, a fear she cannot shake. Chicago rising like bile in her throat. The anger in her chest, the venom in his eyes. I would rather be a ghost. She had been wrong. She does not want to be this kind of ghost. And so, for the first time in centuries, Addie prays. She slides the wooden band over her finger and holds her breath, expects to feel something, a stirring of magic, a rush of wind. But there is nothing. Nothing. And she wonders if, after all this time, it was just another trick, a way to lift her hopes only to drop them in the chance they might shatter. She has a curse ready on her tongue when she feels the breeze, not biting, but warm, cutting through the prison cell, carrying the far-off scent of summer. The men across the cell stop talking. They slouch in their corner, awake but inert, staring off into space as if caught in the throes of some idea. Beyond the cell, the soldiers' boots stop sounding on the stones, and the German voices drop away like a pebble down a well. The world goes strangely, impossibly quiet. Until the only sound is the soft, almost rhythmic tap of fingers trailing along bars. She has not seen him since Chicago. "Oh, Adeline," he says, hand drifting down the icy bars. "What a state you're in." She manages a small, pained laugh. "Immortality breeds a high tolerance for risk." "There are things worse than death," he says, as if she does not already know. He looks around at the prison, brow furrowed in disdain. "Wars," he mutters. "Tell me you are not helping them." Luke almost looks offended. "Even I have limits." "You bragged to me once about the successes of Napoleon." He shrugs.
"There is ambition and there is evil. And as much as I'd like to create a roster of my past exploits, your life is the important one right now."
He leans his elbows on the bars.
"How do you plan to get out of this?"
She knows what he wants her to do. He wants her to beg, as if donning the ring were not enough. As if he has not already won this hand, this game. Her stomach knots, and her bruised ribs ache, and she is so thirsty she could cry just to have something to drink. But Addie cannot bring herself to fold. "You know me," she says with a tired smile. "I always find a way." Luke sighs.
"Suit yourself," he says, turning his back, and it is too much. She cannot bear the thought of him leaving her here alone.
"Wait," she calls desperately, pushing into the bars, only to find the lock undone, the cell door swinging open beneath her weight. Luke looks back over his shoulder, and he almost smiles, turning toward her just enough to offer up his hand. She stumbles forward, out of the cell and into freedom, into him. And for a moment, the embrace is only that, and he is solid and warm, folded around her in the dark. And it would be easy to believe that he is real, that he is human, that he is home. But then the world cracks wide, and the shadows swallow them whole. The prison gives way to nothingness, to blackness, to the wild dark. And when it parts, she is back in Boston, the sun just beginning to set, and she could kiss the ground in sheer relief. Addie pulls the jacket close around her and sinks onto the curb, legs shaking, the wooden band still wrapped around her finger. She called, and he came. She asked, and he answered. And she knows he will hold it over her, but right now she does not care. She does not want to be alone. But by the time Addie looks up to thank him, he is gone. New York City, July 30th, 2014. 8. Henry trails her through the apartment as she gets ready.
"Why would you agree to this?" he asks.
Because she knows the darkness better than anyone, knows his mind, if not his heart. "Because I don't want to lose you," says Addie, pulling up her hair. Henry looks tired, hollowed out.
"It's too late," he says.
But it's not too late. Not yet. Addie reaches into her pocket and feels the ring where it always is, waiting, the wood warm from being pressed against her body. She draws it out, but Henry catches her hand.
"Don't do this," he pleads.
"Do you want to die?" she asks, the words cutting through the room. He pulls back a little at the words.
"No, but I made a choice, Addie. You made a mistake. I made a deal," he says, "and I'm sorry. I'm sorry I didn't ask for more time. I'm sorry I didn't tell you the truth sooner, but it is what it is."
Addie shakes her head.
You may have made peace with this, Henry, but I haven't. This won't work, he warns. You can't reason with him. Addie tugs free of his grip. I'm willing to try, she says, slipping the ring over her finger. There is no flood of darkness, only a stillness, a vacant quiet, and then a knock. And she is grateful that at least he didn't invite himself in. But Henry stands between her and the door, his hands braced across the narrow hall. He doesn't move, his eyes pleading. Addie reaches up and cups his face. I need you to trust me, she says. Something cracks in him. One hand drops from the frame. She kisses him and then slides by and opens the door for the dark. Adeline. Luke should look out of place in the building's hall, but he never does. The lights on the walls have dimmed a little, softened to a yellow haze that halos the black curls around his face and catches slivers of gold in his green eyes. He is dressed in all black, tailored slacks and a button-down shirt, the sleeves rolled to the elbows, an emerald pin driven through the silk tie at his throat. It is far too hot for such an outfit, but Luke doesn't seem to mind. The heat, like the rain, like the world itself, seems to have no hold on him. He does not tell her she looks beautiful. He does not tell her anything. He simply turns, expecting her to follow. And as she steps into the hall, he looks to Henry and winks. Addie should have stopped right there. She should have turned around, let Henry pull her back inside. They should have shut the door and bolted it against the dark. But they didn't. They don't. Addie glances back over her shoulder at Henry, who lingers in the doorway, a cloud shadowing his face. She wills him to close the door, but he doesn't, and she has no choice but to step away and follow Luke as Henry watches. Downstairs, he holds open the building's door, but Addie stops, looks down at the threshold. Darkness coils in the frame, shimmers between them and the steps down to the street. She doesn't trust the shadows. She can't see where they lead, and the last thing she needs is for Luke to strand her in some far-off land if and when the night goes bad. There are rules tonight, she says.
Oh?
I won't leave the city, she says, nodding at the door. And I won't go that way.
Through a door?
Through the dark. Luke's brows draw up.
Don't you trust me?
I never have, she says. There's no use starting now. Luke laughs, soft and soundless, and steps outside to hail a car. Seconds later, a sleek black sedan pulls up to the curb. He holds out his hand to help her in. She doesn't take it. He does not give the driver an address. The driver does not ask for one. And when Addie asks where they are going, Luke does not answer. Soon they are on the Manhattan Bridge. The silence between them should be awkward, the halting conversation of exes too long apart, and still not long enough to have forgiven anything. What is 40 years against 300? But this is a silence born of strategy. This is the silence of a chess game being played. And this time, Addie has to win. Los Angeles, California, April 7th, 1952. 9.
God, you're beautiful, says Max, lifting his glass.
Addie blushes, eyes dropping to her martini. They met on the street outside the Wilshire that morning, the creases from his bedsheets still pressed into her skin. She was lingering on the curb in his favorite wine-colored dress, and when he came out for his morning stroll, he stopped and asked if he could be so bold as to walk with her, wherever she was going. And when they got there, to a pretty building picked at random, he kissed her hand and said goodbye, but he didn't leave, and neither did she.
They spent the whole day together, strolling from a tea shop to a park to the art museum, finding excuses to continue in each other's company. And when she told him that it was the best birthday she'd had in years, he blinked at her in horror, shocked at the idea a girl like her would find herself alone. And here they are, drinking martinis at the Roosevelt. It is not her birthday, of course, and she's not sure why she told him it was, perhaps to see what he would do, perhaps because even she is getting bored of living the same night over again. "Have you ever met someone," he says, "and felt like you've known them for ages?" Addie smiles. He always says the same things, but he means them every time. She toys with the silver thread at her throat, the wooden ring tucked into the neckline of her dress, a habit she cannot seem to break. A server appears at her elbow with a bottle of champagne. "What's this?" she asks.
"For the birthday girl on this special evening," says Max brightly, "and the lucky gentleman who gets to spend it with her."
She admires the tiny bubbles rising through the flute, knows even before she takes a sip that it's the real thing, old, expensive. Knows, too, that Max can easily afford the luxury. He is a sculptor. Addie has always had a weakness for the fine arts, and talented, yes, but far from starving. Unlike so many of the artists Addie has been with, he comes from money. The family funds sturdy enough to weather the wars and the lean years between them. He raises his glass, just as a shadow falls across the table. She assumes it's their server, but then Max looks up and frowns a little.
"Can I help you?"
And Addie hears a voice like silk and smoke.
"I do believe you can."
There is Luke. Dressed in an elegant black suit. He is beautiful. He is always beautiful.
"Hello, my dear."
Max's frown deepens.
"Do you two know each other?"
"No," she says, at the same time Luke says,
"Yes."
And it's not fair the way his voice carries and hers does not. "He's an old friend," she says, a biting edge in her tone. "But..." Again, he cuts her off.
"But we haven't seen each other in a while, so if you'd be so kind..."
Max bristles.
"That's quite impertinent. Go."
It is just one word, but the air ripples with the force of it, the syllable wrapping like gauze around her date. The fight drops out of Max's face, the annoyance smooths, and his eyes go glassy as he rises from the table and walks away. He never even looks back. "Damn it," she swears, sinking in her seat. "Why must you be such an ass?" Luke lowers himself into the vacant chair and lifts the bottle of champagne, refilling their glasses.
"Your birthday is in March."
"When you get to be my age," she says, "you celebrate as often as you like."
"How long have you been with him?"
2 months. "It's not so bad," she says, sipping her drink. "He falls for me every day."
"And forgets you every night."
The words bite, but not as deeply as they used to. "At least he keeps me company." Those emerald eyes trail over her skin.
"So would I," he says, "if you wanted it."
A flush of warmth sweeps across her cheeks. He cannot know that she has missed him, thought of him the way she used to think of her stranger, alone in bed at night, thought of him every time she toyed with the ring at her throat, and every time she didn't. "Well," she says, finishing her drink, "you've stripped me of my date. The least you can do is try and fill the space." And just like that, the green in Luke's eyes is back, brighter.
"Come,"
he says, drawing her up from her chair.
"The night is young, and we can do far better."
The Cicada Club buzzes with life. Art Deco chandeliers hang low, shining up against a burnished ceiling. It is crushed red carpet and stairs sweeping up to balcony seats. It is linen-covered tables and a polished dance floor set before a low stage. They arrive as a brass band finishes its set, trumpets and sax spilling through the club. The place is packed, and yet, when Luke draws her through the crowd, there is a table sitting empty at the front, the best in the house. They take their seats, and moments later a waiter appears, two martinis balanced on his tray. She thinks of that first dinner they shared in the Marquis's house centuries ago, the meal ready before she even agreed to have it, and wonders if Luke planned this in advance, or if the world simply bends to meet his wish. The crowd erupts in cheers as a new performer takes the stage. A narrow man with a wan face, narrow brows arching beneath a gray fedora. Luke stares at him with the sharp pride of something owned. "What's his name?" she asks.
"Sinatra,"
he answers as the band lifts and the man begins to sing. A crooner's melody, smooth and sweet, spills into the room. Addie listens, mesmerized, and then men and women begin to rise from their chairs and step out onto the dance floor. Addie stands, holding out her hand. "Dance with me," she says. Luke looks up at her, but doesn't rise. "Max would have danced with me," she says. She expects him to refuse her, but Luke rises to his feet and takes her hand, leading her onto the floor. She expects him to be stiff, unyielding, but Luke moves with the fluid grace of wind rushing through fields of wheat, of storms rolling through the summer skies. She tries to remember a time they were this close and can't. They have always kept their distance. Now, the space collapses. His body wraps around hers like a blanket, like a breeze, like the night itself. But tonight, he does not feel like a thing of shadow and smoke. Tonight, his arms are solid against her skin. His voice slides through her hair.
"Even if everyone you met remembered," Luke says, "I would still know you best."
She searches his face. "Do I know you?" He bows his head over hers.
"You are the only one who does."
Their bodies press together, one shaped to fit the other perfectly. His shoulder molded to her cheek, his hands molded to her waist, his voice molded to the hollow places in her as he says,
"I want you."
And then again,
"I have always wanted you."
Luke looks down at her, those green eyes dark with pleasure, and Addie fights to hold her ground.
"You want me as a prize," she says. "You want me as a meal or a glass of wine, just another thing to be consumed."
He dips his head, presses his lips to her collarbone.
"Is that so wrong?"
She fights back a shiver as he kisses her throat.
"Is it such a bad thing?"
His mouth trails along her jaw.
"To be savored."
His breath brushes her ear.
"To be relished."
His mouth hovers over hers, and his lips, too, are molded to her own. She will never be quite sure which happened first. If she kissed him or he kissed her, who began the gesture and who rose to meet it, she will only know that there was space between them and it has vanished. She has thought of kissing Luke before, of course, when he was just a figment of her mind, and then when he was more. But in all her conjurings, he'd taken her mouth as if it is a prize. After all, that is how he kissed her the night they met, when he sealed the deal with the blood on her lips. That is how she assumed he would always kiss. But now, he kisses her like someone tasting poison, cautious, questing, almost afraid. And only when she answers, returns the kiss in kind, does he deepen his advance, his teeth skating along her bottom lip, the weight and heat of his body pressing against hers. He tastes like the air at night, heady with the weight of summer storms. He tastes like the faint traces of far-off wood smoke, a fire dying in the dark. He tastes like the forest, and somehow, impossibly, like home. And then darkness reaches up around her, around them, and the cicada club vanishes, the low music and the crooner's melody swallowed up by the pressing void, by rushing wind and racing hearts, and Addie is falling forever and a single step backward. And then her feet find the smooth marble floor of a hotel room, and Luke is there, pressing her forward, and she is there, drawing him back against the nearest wall. His arms lift around her, forming a loose and open cage. She could break it if she tried. She doesn't try. He kisses her again, and this time he is not tasting poison. This time there is no caution, no pulling back. The kiss is sudden, sharp, and deep, stealing air and thought and leaving only hunger. And for a moment, Addie can feel the yawning dark, feel it opening around her, even though the ground is still there. She has kissed a lot of people, but none of them will ever kiss like him. The difference doesn't lie in the technicalities. His mouth is no better shaped to the task. It is just in the way he uses it. It is the difference between tasting a peach out of season and that first bite into sun-ripened fruit. The difference between seeing only in black and white and a life in full-color film. That first time, it is a kind of fight, neither letting down their guard, each watching for the telltale glint of some hidden blade seeking flesh. When they finally collide, it is with all the force of bodies kept too long apart. It is a battle waged on bedsheets. And in the morning, the whole room shows the signs of their war.
"It's been so long," he says, "since I haven't wanted to leave."
She looks at the window, the first thin edge of light. "Then don't."
"I must," he says. "I am a thing of darkness."
She props her head up on one hand.
"Will you vanish with the sun?"
"I will simply go where it is dark again."
Addie rises, goes to the window, and draws the curtains closed, plunging the room back into lightless black. "There," she says, feeling her way back to him.
"Now it is dark again."
Luke laughs, a soft, beautiful sound, and pulls her down into the bed. Everywhere, Nowhere. 1952 to 1968. 10. It is only sex. At least it starts that way. He is a thing to be gotten out of her system. She is a novelty to be enjoyed. Addie half expects them to burn out in a single night, to waste whatever energy they've gathered in their years of spinning. But 2 months later, he comes to find her again, steps out of nothing and back into her life, and she thinks about how strange it is to see him against the reds and golds of autumn, the changing leaves, a charcoal scarf looped loose around his throat. It is weeks until his next visit, and then only days. So many years of solitary nights, hours of waiting and hating and hoping. Now he is there. Still, Addie makes herself small promises in the space between his visits. She will not linger in his arms. She will not fall asleep beside him. She will not feel anything but his lips on her skin, his hands tangled in hers, the weight of him against her. Small promises, but ones she does not keep. It is only sex. And then It is not.
Dine with me, Luke says as winter gives way to spring. Dance with me, he says as a new year begins. Be with me, he says at last as one decade slips into the next.
And one night, Addie wakes in the dark to the soft pressure of his fingertips drawing patterns on her skin, and she is struck by the look in his eyes. No, not the look. The knowing. It is the first time that she has woken up in bed with someone who hasn't already forgotten her. The first time she's heard her name again after the pause of sleep. The first time she hasn't felt alone. And something in her splinters. Addie does not hate him anymore, has not for a long time. She does not know when the shift started, if it was a specific point in time, or, as Luke once warned her, the slow erosion of a coast. All she knows is that she is tired, and he is the place she wants to rest, and that somehow she is happy. But it is not love. Whenever Addie feels herself forgetting, she presses her ear to his bare chest and listens for the drum of life, the drawing of breath, and hears only the woods at night, the quiet hush of summer. A reminder that he is a lie, that his face and his flesh are simply a disguise. That he is not human, and this is not love.
New York City, July 30th, 2014. 11. The city slides past beyond the window, but Addie doesn't turn her head, doesn't admire the skyline of Manhattan, the buildings soaring to every side. Instead, she studies Luke, reflected in the darkened glass, the line of his jaw, the arc of his brow, angles drawn by her hand so many, many years ago. She is watching him the way one watches a wolf at the edge of the woods, waiting to see what it will do. He is the first to break the silence, the first to move a piece.
Do you remember the opera in Munich?
I remember everything, Luke.
The way you looked at the players on that stage, as if you'd never seen theater before.
I'd never seen theater like that.
The wonder in your eyes at the sight of something new. I knew then I'd never win.
She wants to savor the words like a sip of good wine, but the grapes turn sour in her mouth. She does not trust them. The car pulls to a stop outside Le Cuckoo, a beautiful French restaurant on the lower side of Soho, ivy climbing the outer walls. She has been there before, two of the best meals she's had in New York, and she wonders if Luke knows how much she likes it, or if he simply shares her taste. Again, he offers his hand. Again, she does not take it. Addie watches a couple as they approach the doors of the restaurant, only to find them locked, watches them walk away, murmuring something about reservations. But when Luke takes the handle, the door swings open easily. Inside, massive chandeliers hang from the high ceilings, and the large glass windows shine black. The place feels cavernous, large enough to seat 100, but tonight it is empty, save for two chefs visible in the open kitchen, a pair of servers, and the maitre d', who drops into a low bow as Luke approaches.
Monsieur Dubois, he says in a dreamy voice. Mademoiselle.
He leads them to their table, a red rose set before each plate. The maitre d' pulls back her chair, and Luke waits for her to take her seat before taking his own. The man opens a bottle of Merlot and pours, and Luke lifts his glass to her and says,
"To you, Adeline."
There is no menu, no order to be taken. The plates simply arrive. Foie gras with cherries and rabbit terrine, halibut in beurre blanc, and fresh baked bread, and half a dozen kinds of cheese.
The food is, of course, exquisite. But as they eat, the host and servers stand against the walls, eyes open, empty, a bland expression on their faces. She has always hated this aspect of his power and the careless way he wields it. She tips her glass in the direction of the puppets.
"Send them away," she says, and he does. A silent gesture, and the servers disappear, and they are alone in the empty restaurant.
"Would you do that to me?" she asks when they are gone. Luke shakes his head.
"I could not,"
he says, and she thinks he means because he cared for her too much, but then he says,
"I have no power over promised souls. Their will is their own."
It is cold comfort, she thinks, but it is something. Luke looks down into his wine. He turns the stem between his fingers, and there in the darkened glass, she sees the two of them, tangled in silk sheets, sees her fingers in his hair, his hands playing songs against her skin.
"Tell me, Adeline," he says, "have you missed me?"
Of course she has missed him. She can tell herself, as she has told him, that she only missed being seen, or missed the force of his attention, the intoxication of his presence. But it is more than that. She missed him the way someone might miss the sun in winter, though they still dread its heat. She missed the sound of his voice, the knowing in his touch, the flint-on-stone friction of their conversations, the way they fit together. He is gravity. He is 300 years of history. He is the only constant in her life, the only one who will always, always remember. Luke is the man she dreamed of when she was young, and then the one she hated most, and the one she loved, and Addie missed him every night that he was gone from her, and he deserved none of her pain because it was his fault. It was his fault no one else remembered. It was his fault that she lost and lost and lost. And she does not say any of that because it will change nothing, and because there is still one thing she hasn't lost— one piece of her story that she can save. Henry. So Addie makes her gambit. She reaches across the table and takes Luke's hand, tells him the truth. "I missed you." His green eyes shimmer and shift at the words. He brushes the ring on her finger, traces the whorls in the wood.
"How many times did you almost put it on?"
he asks.
"How often did you think of me?"
And she assumes he is baiting her, until his voice softens to a whisper, the faintest roll of thunder in the air between them.
"Because I thought of you. Always."
"You didn't come."
"You didn't call."
She looks down at their tangled hands. "Tell me, Luke," she says. "Was any of it real?"
"What is real to you, Adeline, since my love counts for nothing?"
"You are not capable of love." He scowls, his eyes flashing emerald.
"Because I am not human? Because I do not wither and die?"
"No," she says, drawing back her hand. "You are not capable of love because you cannot understand what it is to care for someone else more than yourself. If you loved me, you would have let me go by now." Luke flicks his fingers.
"What nonsense," he says. "It is because I love you that I won't. Love is hungry. Love is selfish."
"You are thinking of possession." He shrugs.
"Are they so different? I have seen what humans do to things they love."
"People are not things," she says, "and you will never understand them."
"I understand you, Adeline. I know you better than anyone in this world."
"Because you let me have no one else." She takes a steadying breath. "I know you won't spare me, Luke, and perhaps you are right, we do belong together. So if you love me, spare Henry Strauss. If you love me, let him go." His temper flashes through his face.
"This is our night, Adeline. Do not ruin it with talk of someone else,"
But you said—
Come, he says, pushing back from the table. This place no longer suits my taste.
The server has just set a pear tart on the table, but it turns to ash as Luke speaks, and Addie marvels the way she always has at the moodiness of gods.
Luke, she starts, but he is already on his feet, casting the napkin off onto the ruined food.